Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, as the issue of asylum has become central to the debate over the border, we talk about its history and what it's meant to do, and why the R word has made a comeback today. But first, the CHIPS Act has had a big impact in Arizona, spurring a burgeoning semiconductor industry and bringing billions in investments to the state. But the Republican presidential ticket is taking aim at it. Former President Donald Trump has criticized the bill, a signature achievement of President Joe Biden, saying Taiwan, quote, took our chip business. The bill provided billions of dollars to the massive Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing company being built north of the valley. But proponents in the business world say it's also resulted in tens of thousands of jobs here. The CHIPS Act in general has provided more than $15 billion in grants to businesses that have a footprint in Arizona. So what might happen to the CHIPS Act if Trump wins next week? And how is it being used as a campaign issue today? Here to explain it all is Wayne Shutsky here with KJZZ's Politics Desk. Hey there, Wayne.
Good morning.
All right. So the CHIPS Act has been a big deal in Arizona. We've talked about it a lot on the show. It was championed by some of our top lawmakers here. It has had a big financial impact here. What are we hearing from the Trump campaign about how it might fare under a Trump administration?
So they haven't come out with any direct policy proposals, but they've been quite critical of the program. Over the summer, former President Trump criticized specifically the grants given to Taiwan Semiconductor, as you mentioned, saying that they're taking our chip business, you know, criticizing investment in an overseas company like that. Mm-hmm. And more recently, he's kind of criticized the program more broadly, basically saying he would have preferred to use something like tariffs to encourage folks to build their fabrication plants in the United States instead of giving these very large multi-billion-dollar corporations, billions of dollars in grants.
So we've also heard his running mate, J.D. Vance, talk about this, and a little differently, it sounds like. You were here or there when he was here in the Valley last week in Peoria talking about this. What did he have to say about the CHIPS Act?
Yeah, I asked him, you know, about that criticism that Trump had levied on the program, and he came at it and said that it was essentially a politically motivated program that, you know, the Department of Commerce, and he cited Vice President Harris, as who's running for president, obviously, said that they're basically only giving this money out to people who are doing what they want politically. Mm. And yeah, so that was that they're basically only handing it out to political allies or something of that nature.
Is there any evidence to back that up, that the Biden administration has kind of inserted politics into who gets this kind of funding?
No. I spoke with some folks who kind of watchdog this kind of stuff and keep track of where this money is going. And they're like, no, there's a whole office that was set up by the Department of Commerce to lay this out. There's really only a limited number of companies qualify for the money anyway, because there's so few chip manufacturers
who do this.
And, yeah. And that, you know, there's a whole process and that there's no evidence. Now, I did hear from some Republicans that he may have been referring to these DEI requirements that are in the CHIPS Act that was in the actual legislation, requiring things like, helping women and underrepresented groups in the industry get jobs in the industry, that kind of thing. Now, but that's not what he said. I mean, what he actually said was, is, you know, you're not giving this to people unless they're doing what you want politically. And there's not any evidence of that.
Interesting. OK, there's also been some backlash to this on the Democratic side, some Arizona Democrats who are making this a campaign issue in turn. Right. What are they saying?
Yeah. Mark Kelly and Greg Stanton recently had an event, kind of a get out the vote event for Vice President Harris, and talked about that specifically. And what they said, they basically accused the Trump campaign of trying to kill the Arizona economy. Because as you mentioned, Arizona is one of the largest beneficiaries of this CHIPS Act funding. Senator Kelly was one of the architects of the legislation. And we've got Taiwan Semiconductor, we've got Intel, and we've got some smaller projects that are all receiving either grants or loans through the CHIPS Act.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so neither Trump nor Vance has directly said they would like take back, claw back this money that's been doled out via the CHIPS Act. Have they said anything about what they would do?
As I mentioned, Trump said he'd rather use tariffs, which is something he's kind of in a variety of different policy areas said he wants to use to try and boost American manufacturing. That's really the most clear policy proposal. Beyond that, it seems like it's more of a political move because, as you said, this is one of the Biden administration and by connection, Vice President Harris's greatest accomplishments during or seen as the greatest accomplishments during their time in office. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I think, trying to take some of the wind out of those sails, because previously, even Republicans who didn't vote for this had been touting the projects in their districts that were funded by this thing. So it's been mostly popular beyond that DEI criticism amongst Democrats and a lot of Republicans.
Have we heard any reaction to this kind of critique from the Trump ticket from the business community here, which has been such a champion of this?
I haven't heard anything specifically, but you can imagine that with all of the billions of dollars that are coming in to the state, folks like the Chamber of Commerce and like that aren't going to be too happy for someone who's trying to knock that down. Because, again, these companies are investing tens of billions on top of those grants they're receiving. Mm-hmm. It's not like that factory up in North Phoenix is just going to cost the $6.6 billion they're going to get in those grants. It's going to cost somewhere like $65 billion.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, well, less than a week now before Election Day, Wayne. So while I have you here, before I let you go, I have to ask you about what you are watching for heading into this final week of this very hectic, very frantic election cycle. We've seen 1.6 million ballots returned in Arizona already, I think it was this morning. The presidential race here looks neck and neck. What are you watching for?
I'm watching those early ballots. You know, right now, Republicans have a pretty sizable advantage in the ballots that have come in so far, which isn't surprising. Historically, that is the case. There's more Republicans in Arizona than any other group. But seeing if Democrats can close that gap a little bit, because I think that's going to tell us a lot about how some of these very close races like president, Senate are going to turn out. Not to say it's going to be the only decisive factor, because obviously we've seen a lot of split ticket voters in recent years who might vote for a Republican in one race at the top of the ticket and Democrat somewhere else and vice versa.
Right. Fair enough. And at this point, with that many ballots returned, how much is this saying, or how much are you watching, I guess, the big registration advantage that Republicans have in the state? It's going to be kind of consistent, right?
Yeah. I mean, Republicans have only increased that registration advantage since the last election. So and now they're returning, as I said, to their norm, which is dominating early voting. Mm-hmm. That kind of took a hit in recent years with some leaders in the Republican Party, former President Trump, former state party chairwoman Kelly Ward, criticizing early and mail-in voting and telling people not to do it. They saw that didn't work out for them last time, and they've really reversed course on that. And there are so many get out the votes efforts, so many vote early, vote now type of things. Carrie Lake's been saying it a lot, and Republicans thus far have been responding, and we're seeing their ballots come in at a pretty high clip.
Yeah, seems like it. Okay, we'll leave it there for now. Wayne Shetsky with our politics desk. Wayne, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Yep, thank you.
Immigration and the border are on the ballot in multiple ways in Arizona, from the heated rhetoric around immigration coming from the presidential campaigns to Prop 314, which would make it a state crime to enter Arizona outside a port of entry. But all of the talk about a crisis on the border has been blunted by an executive order from President Joe Biden that has severely limited asylum at the border. We've seen the number of migrant crossings at the border drop dramatically since. Immigrant advocates decried that order, calling it a violation of the fundamental right to seek asylum here. Others say that right was being abused, that most of the migrants arriving here asking for asylum won't even qualify for it. Well, our next guest says in today's world, the problem isn't going anywhere. Evelyn Cruz is director of the Immigration Clinic at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, and she told me asylum is an idea that goes back as far as the Greeks, but its modern day history began after World War II in the United States. After Congress had enacted an immigration law that severely restricted the number of immigrants allowed into the country for the first time.
During World War II, that came to be very significant because a lot of individuals were fleeing from Poland and from Germany because of the Nazi situation, but they could not enter the United States. Mm. And famously, there were a lot of individuals who were turned away on the boats and circled back to Europe and ended up in death camps.
After the war, countries agreed there should be a system through which people who needed protection could get it. That system became the asylum system. But even with it, Cruz told me, in the United States, asylum is much more limited than it is in much of the rest of the world.
In the United States, we basically have to fit into one of five categories. Mm-hmm. Persecution based on religion, race, ethnicity, a particular social group, or a political reason. Mm-hmm. And that is very limited. Other countries have agreed to regional asylum rules that include general violence or include inability to provide for the basic necessities of individuals. So qualifying for asylum in the United States is very, very difficult.
So this obviously has changed today, this conversation. Like, understanding asylum today feels a little different than it has in the past, because we've seen the numbers of asylum seekers just skyrocket on the U.S.-Mexico border in recent years. When we've seen the response to that politically, the Biden administration severely restricting asylum just in recent months, and then, you know, seeing an immediate drop in the number of people trying to do it. I wonder, like, this debate, this current situation, and the current, like, global migration situation, how do you think that's changed the conversation?
Well, to some extent, mobility has been one of the main reasons why we are changing the number of people who are seeking to be protected. Spain sees a good number of people from Latin America seeking asylum.
People from all over the world
but
are going to places all over
exactly.
the world. Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so movement of people due to displacement for anything from natural disasters, global warming, wars, it's something that has been going on since the Greeks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the ability of people to move, to connect with people and resources in other countries that they would normally not have gravitated towards has increased.
Right. So this is why we're seeing more of it right now.
Correct. We have a lot of different reasons why people are being forced away from their homes.
Mm-hmm. So looking at the U.S.-Mexico border and the numbers of people arriving here, the language of invasion, I wonder what you think that does to the idea, the assumption that we had in this country for a long time that asylum was a right.
Well, it's not asylum per se that is a right, but the idea that you should have an opportunity to be heard and present your claim under which you would qualify for those protections.
Right.
But the thing that has been whittling away from it is the ability of individuals to gain an opportunity to present their claims for one reason or another. The first has been limitations on appeals. And then you also have the conditions of expedited processes in which individuals are not able to first acclimate themselves. A lot of them may have endured traumas in their homeland or on their travels to the United States. Mm-hmm. A lot of percentage of women seek out birth control before getting on the road to the United States or to any other country because they know that there's a likelihood that they're going to be raped. And so if you are arriving and you have had this trauma and you don't have the language, the culture, the understanding of what process is currently being undertaken, because they keep changing, you're not likely to be prepared to express the reasons why you should be considered for this protection.
Okay, so it's gotten harder in those ways. And then it got way harder, right, recently when the Biden administration sort of changed the rules and has basically capped this when there are certain thresholds met of people arriving at the border.
So it demonstrated that one of the biggest challenges that we have always had with asylum is that there's only two ways that you can present yourself to request asylum. You are in a United Nations refugee camp. The only other way that you could apply for asylum is that you need to present yourself at the U.S. border.
Yes.
Either at the border's entry point or at the airport. And so those very limited pathways meant that individuals who want to be protected have a genuine fear and are presenting themselves at the border have been demonized for doing exactly what they are supposed to do in order to get that protection.
That's really interesting. So critics really will say that this right that people assume they have to seek asylum here, to at least try to get asylum here, is being abused, essentially, that this massive number of people arriving at the border and asking for asylum, most of them in the end will not pass that high threshold and actually receive asylum. What's your response to those criticisms?
So there's a catch-22 when it comes to asylum. You have to demonstrate that you are in danger. That is a likelihood that you're going to be harmed in your home country. The longer it takes for individuals to be processed through the system, the more likely that that hopefully has dissipated. And in some ways, they have received the benefit they sought. They were protected during the time that they were in danger.
Right.
Now you have someone who's being denied, and you say, see, this person didn't have an asylum claim to begin with. But the other thing is that we, meaning countries, have a responsibility to understand what those conditions are in those countries and to invest in not making them worse and finding ways to improve situations. I've done research work in El Salvador, in Mexico, and in Pakistan, working with universities in those countries to establish better legal systems that provide an avenue for marginalized communities to access the legal system and feel some trust in their system. And so those are the kind of things that are going to reduce the amount of individuals who may decide to come to the United States for reasons that are genuinely connected to an inability to make a life. Most often than not, immigrants would rather stay home. If the conditions in their home country were amicable to having a normal life, being able to invest in yourself and not believe that some military person is going to go, well, give me your cows because I need to feed my troops and you have no way of asking the authorities to enforce your right over your cows. Those are the kind of things that diminish their ability to say things can get better. And that's often what leads them to take a very dangerous path coming to the United States.
Right. So you're talking about the causes that send people, right?
Mm-hmm.
What about the other side of that? Like, what do you think the answer is on the U.S. side when we're not going to see numbers of people migrating around the world go down? It seems like countries all over the world are sort of grappling with that issue, right? Like, how do we handle the unprecedented numbers of people who have this kind of mobility now and also often have reason to flee? I mean, what is the answer?
Investment in long-term solutions that provide a better option than to migrate.
So you've got to start at those root causes.
You have to start at those roots. And to some extent, the United States oftentimes does not balance well the idea of how you manage the flow of individuals in a way that provides a protection for those who absolutely need the protection and provides a way for those who don't to understand why they don't qualify, because oftentimes people who do not understand why they were denied a relief believe that is due because there's some nefarious reason to it, and will try to find someone else who might grant them that status. A lot of the numbers from the Border Patrol are multiple entry people. It's not just 50,000 people enter today. It's 5,000 that enter three times. This was the third time they were entering.
Right.
And so there are a number of other things that we can do if we start from understanding that human beings are going to do what's best for their family and are going to do what they feel has honored their humanity.
All right. Evelyn Cruz, clinical law professor and director of the Immigration Clinic at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, joining us. Evelyn, thank you for coming in. Thanks for explaining this to us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, an untraditional way to get a community to the polls.
Three things I love: yoga, dancing, and voting.
I think that voting is very important and it matters to make your voice heard, and I wanted to bring some good energy to the polls.
We'll hear from one of the founders of the group, Daybreaker. But first, the use of the R word to describe people, especially those with intellectual disabilities, dropped off, at least in public, a little more than a decade ago, after a coordinated campaign to get people not to use it. But over the last few years, it started coming back. The New York Times reported this month that former President Trump used the word to describe Vice President Kamala Harris at a recent donor dinner, for example. But the R word doesn't just seem to be coming back in certain settings or out of the mouths of certain people. So why is that? What led to this slur seemingly becoming acceptable to use again? To talk about this, my co-host Mark Brody spoke with Constance Grady, senior correspondent at Vox.com, and she's written about it. And they started with what first got her thinking about the use of this word and its history of being used and then going away and then, as she reports, coming back.
Yeah, the R word is something that really surprised me over the past few months as I started to see it coming back in these really kind of prominent ways. You know, Shane Gillis is a pretty big comedian and he was using the R word in his sets. I was seeing a lot of people who would have identified as being left wing who were using the word kind of in this way that seemed to be suggesting, you know, I'm cruel and I'm edgy, and this is the word that cruel, edgy people use. And it really startled me because it was so recent that it seemed as though so many people stopped using the R word and kind of decided that it was no longer a word that was okay to use all the time and just throw around as an insult.
Well, is there anything to be gleaned from the way in which it went from being a word that could be used to one that really couldn't and shouldn't, to explain why it's sort of coming back in certain situations now?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, the R word really was a huge success story in a lot of ways for disability rights activists. The Special Olympics organization launched their campaign, Spread the Word to End the Word, in 2007, after the film Tropic Thunder became a big hit, and that had a long joke about the R word.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of galvanized activists to say, okay, let's get out there. Let's tell people that a lot of people in the disabled community feel really terrible when they hear this word. They are going from school to school for about a decade. And by 2018, they're basically like, okay, our campaign is over. It was super effective. We are going to these schools and telling them not to say the R word. And the kids at the schools are like, yeah, we already know that. So it was a huge success story for this group. And they really switched their focus and their activism away from that message for a solid 5 or 6 years before they started to feel the need to turn back to it again over the past year or so. And I think that really suggests that people don't seem that interested in using the word when they're being reminded that it hurts the feelings of actual human beings. But when they are in a space where it just seems like kind of a fun, edgy thing to say that will maybe offend prudes, it becomes much more attractive and appealing for them.
Why do you think it is that this particular word that relates to this particular group of people has found itself in that place as opposed to any other word that is derogatory toward any other group of people?
What's really bizarre is this is something that we see happen over and over again, specifically with words that were developed for people with intellectual disabilities. There's a known cycle in linguistics that describes this process. It's called the euphemism cycle, or sometimes the euphemism treadmill. And what it describes is over and over again, people in psychiatry or medicine will develop medical terminology for people with intellectual disabilities. So words like idiotic, moron, feeble-minded all started off as legitimate medical diagnoses. Over time, lay people hear these words and transition them into becoming insults. And then doctors have to come up with new terms for people with intellectual disabilities because the old ones have become so hurtful. This is something that we seem to do over and over again, specifically with people with intellectual disabilities. It's as though we are so, as a society, bothered by the idea of someone having this intellectual disability that we go out of our way to make the words associated with this condition seem humiliating and hurtful.
Yeah, I'm curious if in your mind and maybe in the minds of people with whom you spoke during your research that this says anything about, for example, ableism as related to racism or sexism or any other kind of, you know, discrimination against a particular group of people.
Yeah, I had a really interesting conversation with Christopher Hom. He's a philosopher of language who has done some studies on slurs. He made the really interesting point that a lot of people will think of ableism as being not that bad, definitely not as bad as racism. And it can allow us to kind of hand wave the idea that ableism is maybe not a real prejudice and it isn't actually affecting people's lives. But as Dr. Hom pointed out to me, if you look at the statistics that describe what people's lives are like when they have disabilities, you know, describing their quality of life, how long they can expect to live, what their situations will be, the numbers are really, really terrible in a lot of ways. You know, there are all sorts of structural reasons embedded in our society that allow this state of affairs to continue. And what Dr. Hom said that I thought was so interesting is that ableism is the thing that is producing these structural inequalities, and it's also what's fueling the euphemism treadmill that makes us keep having to replace these medical terminologies as they transition into becoming slurs. He says, I take that as evidence that ableism really is pretty significant in our culture.
So I'm curious what the folks who initially led the campaign to stop people from using the R word in the first place, like what's their plan now that it seems to be coming back?
Yeah, Special Olympics has been talking about bringing the R word, the Stop the Word to End the Word campaign back into schools. They have started re-promoting it on their website. One person I spoke to said that when they re-promoted those sections of their website, they saw a spike in traffic of about 200 to 300%. But I think it's also difficult to show very clearly that the R word is being used more frequently than it used to be. It's really, really hard to measure how often people are using curse words or slurs or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing it in a lot of different places very prominently right now. It's hard to say for sure that more people are using it more frequently.
How is the increase in this word's use impacting the people in this community?
I think in general, I'm just hearing people say that this is a word that suggests that the person who is speaking doesn't respect you and doesn't treat you as, you know, a real human or someone who is smart and worth your time and your respect as a human being. And it's definitely a word that, by and large, they would prefer not be used to describe them.
All right. That is Constance Grady, senior correspondent at Vox.com. Constance, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Now let's head to southeastern Arizona copper country, where a tiny mining town sits in the Arizona desert, and it's dominated by Latinos. Clifton, Arizona is a town of about 4,000 people that's largely fueled by the Morenci mine, one of the largest copper mines in the country. Los Angeles Times columnist Gustavo Arellano wrote about it in a recent column as he drove across the Southwest talking to Latinos leading up to next week's election. And he told me it's part of a long history of Mexican Americans who have lived in that part of our state and worked in the mine, and whose stories have never really been told. His grandparents were among them. I spoke with him more about it.
As I wrote in my column, to get to Clifton, you really have to want to get there. So from Willcox off the 10, you go up I-191, you get into Safford, you start going east, going up, up, up. You pass by Ocotillo, you pass by creosote bushes, all
okay.
of that. Then you see the Morenci mine, which I described as like the Sarlacc monster from Return of the Jedi, you know, like this pit with levels coming down. And then once you actually roll into Clifton, it's immediately Wild West. They have a historic district, buildings from the 1800s, from its boom days. Then the rest of it, it's tiny. We're talking about a population of 4,000 people.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And you went there for a very personal reason, right? Your grandparents are from that area.
Yeah. So I did a big series for the LA Times where I went around the Southwest just telling different stories about Latinos in this election year. And one of the reasons why I went to Clifton is that it's right next to a town that no longer exists, Metcalf, Arizona. That's where my maternal grandmother, mi mamá Chela, that's where she was born in 1912. And her husband, my paternal grandpa, my papá Jé, he lived there as a kid as well. And so you had an entire generation of people from our part of Mexico, Zacatecas, mm-hmm. who ended up in Clifton, Morenci, and Metcalf before they went to Southern California. And that turned out to be a lot of Southern Californians had those same copper roots as my family did.
Right. And so there's this interesting history there. And then you write that a lot of those Mexican immigrants who kind of went through that part of Arizona who ended up in LA have ended up in kind of LA politics.
Oh, yeah. So these are names that are not really familiar probably to most Arizonans, but in Southern California, they're royalty. So we're talking about former council member Richard Alatorre, Romana Bañuelos Acosta, who was the first ever Latina U.S. treasurer. She was born in Miami, or as the locals tell me to pronounce it, Miami, which is on the other side yes. of Clifton. Esteban Torres, also from Miami. You have a MacArthur Genius winner, Ruben Martinez, who had a bookstore owner. He's also from Miami. And so all these different things. And I knew some of that history, but going into, you know, into this, I didn't realize even more names. And this is the interesting thing. After I've published my LA Times column, I'm getting a lot of people from Southern California saying, yes, my family also had roots there. So it's a migration history that really no one has ever written about until now.
Right, exactly. Why I found it so interesting. But it's all, of course, connected to the mine there, the Morenci mine you mentioned, run by Freeport Mac Moran. And what's interesting, and another kind of piece of lost history here, I think, is that this is a town that's majority Latino, that Latinos have worked at this mine for generations. And that story is often not told. Like, when you think about mining in America, you think about, you know, like Appalachia.
Yeah, you think about coal miners, you think about Eastern Europeans working out in Pennsylvania, in, you know, Italians, Hungarians, Croats and all that. You almost never think of Latino miners in the American Southwest. And so that was another reason, you know, if you want to tell a story about politics, you just want to get into it into different levels. And mining was such a big platform for the Trump administration and also the Biden administration. Now, Harris and Trump, they're both campaigning on that issue, but they're not coming down to Southeastern Arizona. They're not coming to copper country, even though you have such a humongous and important mine down here there for you folks.
Right, right. So that's an interesting fact of this. And you talk about the election there, which we'll get to in a second. But I want to talk about someone you spent some time with and kind of profile in this piece, a woman from Clifton who left and came back, who wants to tell that story, right? That story of Latinos in this mine and bring some life back to this part of the state. Tell us about Janine Carrillo.
Yeah, Janine Carrillo, 45 years old, born in the company town of Morenci, which is right next to Clifton, but grew up between both Clifton and Morenci. Once she graduates from high school, she's like, I'm a young woman here. There's no future for me in copper mining. I'm going off to Phoenix. So she spent a decade there. She was a volunteer with the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department. She describes herself as a McCain Republican. So she was a big fan of John McCain. Then Family Matters takes her back to Clifton and she realizes, you know, there's too many people like me, too many young people who just leave and never come back. What can I do to make it so that people remain here? So she originally applied for the Clifton Town Council because Clifton is a town, not a city,
right.
Was not accepted. But in 2022, she ran and she won. So that's one of the big questions she's wrestling with now. And she works for the mine. She's a security guard for the mine, but she knows that eventually there's not going to be copper there anymore. So what can she do to prepare for that moment for Clifton and make it a thriving place?
Right. And it's this tiny place, but it does seem to be having some kind of, you know, moderate comeback, as you call it, I think, in the piece. And you talk to her about that effort, but also about that question, right, that I think all of us would wonder, which is why would people want to stay in a place like this that so many people have left? What did she have to say about that?
Well, right now, Clifton, Morenci, that whole area is booming with jobs. And so she's saying that you have all these people coming from across the country to work at the mine. And it's a big comeback for Clifton. Of course, Arizonans know about the strike that happened down there in the 1980s that sent the city into a downfall. The population at its height was 5,000, went down to like 1,500, I believe, by the 1990 census. The 2020 census has it now at 4,000 people. And so she says, look, there's so many beautiful mountains around us. There's a river, the San Francisco River, that crosses through us. So what can we do to keep people here? Because this is a beautiful area. It's a wonderful place for people to grow up in. And for me, as coming from Southern California, from Los Angeles, Orange County, her dreams, if I wanted to be cynical, they would seem very trite. Like she wants to get a Boston Market in there. She wants to get like a McDonald's. But this would be a huge thing for Clifton because a lot of trucks drive through there. So that means jobs. That means a tax revenue that then allows for civic investment. Like she wants to reopen a gym and she wants to do things to keep that next generation there. So I just found her so so refreshing and so positive, because it's so easy to, when you get stories from mining country, it's always boom and buzz. But she's like, no, I'm in this for the long run.
Wow. Yeah. A rare story for sure. Okay. So let's talk about what the election looks like in this kind of small piece of rural Arizona. What did you find when you walked around there and talked to folks?
Greenlee County voted for Trump in 2020, so I expected a lot of signs about Trump or maybe Harris. There was one sign in the town of Three-Way. It was a big, huge billboard for the Greenlee County Democratic Party, and I can't remember the slogan right now, but it made me laugh. And I saw a lot of political signs, but they were all for local elections, for Greenlee County Sheriff. There's like three candidates running there for the town council, and I asked Councilmember Carrillo about that, and she said, look, we're a small town. Like, we're going to respect what each other votes for on the national level, but we can't be pitted against each other because we're tiny. Maybe on the big city, then you could have those fights, but we care about what's going on here. We have to talk to each other as neighbors. And that's something that I found in my overall series, was that a lot of the Latinos that I talked to, they, yes, they care about national issues, but they really care about the local matters, because local is what you can fix far more so than national issues if you're just one individual.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the Los Angeles Times, joining us to talk more about Clifton, Arizona. Gustavo, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this. I really appreciate it.
Gracias for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Other than listening to the show, how do you like to start your day? The show's Sam Dingman recently met some folks who get moving bright and early.
It's about 7 in the morning, and a woman named Thais is at a dance party.
Honestly, I really like the idea of waking up and dancing.
So does Thais's friend, Scott.
Normally I drink coffee in the morning, but I could just dance instead.
The party is called Daybreaker, and it's the brainchild of Radha Agrawal.
Dance is the most healing technology that exists.
Back in the 2010s, Agrawal was an entrepreneur, an investor, and, as she puts it, a self-conscious dancer. Until one night at Burning Man, the annual festival of art and self-reliance held in the Nevada desert. Her friends had gone to bed, and Agrawal decided to go for a bike ride.
And I found this art car that was playing this music, and I'll never forget throwing my bicycle down and just getting into my body for the first time and having this moment of, tearful remembering of, reconnecting my mind and my body together for the first time. I remember crying and just like, wow, feeling the music in my body and my bones.
Agrawal says the experience was revelatory for two reasons. One, unlike a lot of people at Burning Man, she was completely sober. And two, it happened just before dawn.
The euphoric feeling of this moment of sun rising into a new day as I got to move my body and got to feel the music and come home to my self-expression. It was like truly one of the most awakening experiences of my life. Our body holds all the wisdom. Our body remembers everything of our past. And so the remembering again was, moving from headspace to a reconnection of body-mind space.
When Agrawal got back from Burning Man, she started thinking maybe there was a way to inspire a collective tearful remembering. She felt like dance had been relegated to boozy nightclubs and one-off events like weddings.
Rather than a weekly, monthly practice that you do with your community to move your body, to move your mind, to move your emotions to states of joy and celebration. And, the American way back in the 50s, you used to put your briefcase down, you used to take your apron off, and you would go to the dance hall. That's what we did as Americans.
And so in 2013, Agrawal and a friend came up with a vision to make dance great again.
Can we turn nightlife on its head by throwing dance parties in the morning? What if we replaced the mean bouncers with a hugging committee at the door? What if we replaced the alcohol with green juice? What if we replaced just a DJ pushing buttons with a joyful DJ and a horn section and breakdancers and fire spinners all in the morning before going to work? And so it was really a social experiment.
Now, more than 10 years later, Agrawal's social experiment has become Daybreaker. She stages the events all over the world first thing in the morning.
Daybreaker actually starts with a one-hour yoga experience, which is also inside of an iconic venue. So imagine doing yoga inside of an iconic venue with a beautiful piano or harpist and a didgeridoo player with a bubble machine kind of, you know, misting its way through the dance hall. But then the second 2 hours is a full-on dance party. And imagine you're, you know, in the sunlight dancing, and all of a sudden there's a horn section and a break dancer and fire spinners and all kinds of different wow moments, we call them.
Agrawal sees Daybreaker as a kind of radical healthcare, an unholy hybrid of festival culture and wellness, without what she calls the cheesiness.
Wellness world can often feel pretty earnest. And so can we add the edge and the play and the mischief and the mystery?
These days, there's something else Agrawal thinks could use a little mischief. Voting.
Civic engagement currently today is not a celebration. In fact, it's the opposite. It feels like when you go to vote, it's like going to the DMV.
This fall, Agrawal and her team are bringing Daybreaker to swing state cities like Philadelphia, Ann Arbor, and Kenosha. They're calling it the Purple Tour. The tagline? Party to the polls.
And the whole idea is to really reinvigorate the joy of having a voice, of casting a ballot, of shifting the energetics around the elections. And we're going to basically throw a epic dance party right next to the polling stations or nearby, and then Pied Piper everyone with a horn section and a drum line and flags and bubble machines and stilt walkers all the way to the polling stations. We're bringing pole dancers to every polling station.
Recently, the Purple Tour came to Phoenix, and producer Kirsten Edgett was on the scene.
Oh, I'm an advocate for voting. This is amazing. Fun, nonpartisan, food, music.
This event combines three things I love: yoga, dancing, and voting.
I think that voting is very important and it matters to make your voice heard, and I wanted to bring some good energy to the polls.
Later that morning, when Kirsten got back to the radio station, we sat down in the studio to debrief.
When in the whole process did it become explicitly about voting? Like, are you hearing about how important elections are while you're doing Shavasana?
Actually, yes.
Okay.
There were a couple moments where somebody would be like, they'd be in a certain position and kind of stretching out, and she'd be like, you know, your vote is really important and it's really powerful to own that right that you have as an American and to use that. And so as somebody's in like downward dog, she's like, remember your vote.
Listening to all this, I have to admit, the Purple Tour sounded a little, well, earnest.
It definitely came from a place of like a passion for wanting to get people out into polling booths. It was kind of loving in a way.
Case in point, another guy Kirsten interviewed named Carlos.
It's only made my beliefs in the country and my nation, my USA, more firm. You know, I love the USA.
Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with love. But I wasn't hearing much in the way of the edge and the playfulness and the mischief and the mystery. That is, until Carlos said this.
Life is good, you know, no matter how you vote, I think we're going to be okay.
Given the political rhetoric of 2024, that might be the edgiest thing I've heard all year.
Let's do it. Hallelujah.
The Purple Tour comes to Tucson tomorrow. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
That's it for this episode of The Show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.